Hello, everybody. Welcome to a French Village podcast. I am here with my brilliant friend, Benjamin Wittes, and we have to talk to you about a couple really tough episodes. We've been away. I'm sorry. We took a week off. We're on vacation. I don't think it's fair to say, Ben, that we didn't skip this or prolong it just because we didn't want to talk about these episodes, right? We
genuinely needed vacation. Had I seen them, I would have been like, I can't record on this. This is, and you know, I just also want to say that I blame you.
Oh, okay.
Because nothing you did emotionally prepared me for Marchetti personally dragging Marie up a ladder and hanging her. And I know there is no justice in the universe, but I feel like it was your responsibility to emotionally prepare me for Marie not surviving the show.
So listen, I understand this. I hear you. However, I'm going to take it as a compliment that I got very good at not giving away any tells. As I talked about the show earlier, I feel like you may have even accused me at times of being too soft on Marchetti. And maybe I was overcompensating because I hate Marchetti so much, and have always known this was coming and hated to know we were going to relive it, in these episodes.
My great premise of this show was that the main characters all survive.
Yes.
And, you know, I was shocked when Morhange did not make it. And then one of the, you know, Marcel Larcher doesn't make it. And I thought he was going to not actually be shot until pretty close to the last moment on the theory that the Larcher brothers survived the show. And now we have Marie, who's as close to a main character other than Danielle Larcher himself as the show has, not making it, but also like not just not making it. She doesn't get shot and left in a ditch somewhere. She gets personally hanged by one of the show's great villains. And I just want to say I hold you responsible.
Okay. Well, I'm going to take it because there's really nothing I can do when I dragged you into this entire enterprise. Like, I knew it was all coming. And I got to say, the thing that I sort of like about the show, obviously, because Marie, it's not just that she's a main character. It's that she's maybe as close to like a pure hero as the show gets.
It's as close to a moral center as the show gets.
And so, you know, she is, and I, you know, when we were doing kind of early on, we were doing the like, oh, who would you be in the show? And I aspire to be a Marie. And so to know that you have to go through, you know, a couple of seasons without her, I remember when this was happening the first time being like, I'm not going to kill Marie. Like, it's like one of those things sometimes where you
and
lose a character.
And reacts that way too.
Well,
she
and I want to talk about that.
To Marchetti, you don't have the guts. You're not actually going to do this.
That's right. And I want to. I just want to say one thing about the show overall, which is that, you know, you had said, and I didn't even react when you said it early on, that you had this, you know, this television show premise of main characters' sort of survivability just by virtue of it's a television show. You got to keep your main characters. And I would say, this show, one of the things I like about it is it, you know, lots of people didn't survive World War II and the Holocaust, members of the resistance, Jews, lots and lots and lots of people. And the show is true to that. Like there, it exacts, I mean, obviously not in this, you know, whatever, but like it doesn't just say it operates true, I think, to its form, in a way, and is willing to give up characters for the sake of, and not like a like a Game of Thrones shock.
I was about to say that, you know, Game of Thrones very casually kills off its characters and actually blunts the emotional impact of it by doing it so casually. The French Village, when it kills off a character, it is a big deal. And, you know, it preps the Marcel Larcher death with an entire series of scenes and episodes where he and Shasanya are having, you know, coming to some kind of personal, though certainly not political, relationship, and actually goes through the exercise of making you like Shasanya a little bit better than his vicious, horrible character would lead you to. And here it spends, you know, what season are we in? Five. So four whole seasons setting Marie up as the hero or a hero, only to have her be very casually murdered on the eve of or in the course of liberation. It's a particularly brutal treatment, and of course quite accurate, you know, in the sense that there are a lot of Maries who did not survive the war, and the milice and the Pétain regime, you know, did kill people on their way out. And the chaotic period where that was liberation, except when it wasn't, you know, actually involved a very high death count.
Yes. And you know, it is the part of the brutality of all of it is not just because it's the kind of like intimate murder between two main characters with whom we have like deep and complex relationships, but also because like Germans are hours, minutes from like skipping town. Like this whole thing is almost over. And there's something about the deaths that came right at the end, right before it was all over. There's something just extra excruciating about it. But what was happening that led to this is that, you know, Marchetti, and so because I want to talk about some of the events leading up, because it's I think that the death of Marie has a lot to do with where Marchetti is mentally, and where Marchetti is mentally is due entirely around like the negotiations that are happening about what's going to happen after the regime completely turns over. Everyone knows they're on the precipice of this happening. And so our socialists and our communists, where we're going to start to see them have a less easy relationship now that they don't have a common enemy anymore. But they are negotiating, right? Marchetti and why I'm blanking on my pencil pusher bureaucrat's name.
Servier.
Thank you.
Just remember his name.
Servile.
Is a pun on servile.
Yeah. Right. Servier, they capture Antoine and Suzanne at the end of the last couple of episodes back before Labor Day. You know, it ends with them, you know, hiding in kind of a barn or something and people showing up. It's clear her cousin, who is now married to her husband or not, her husband's cousin that he's now weirdly shacking up with because, you know, French.
Because cousins.
Because French, yeah, French cousins. That she's clearly dimed them out. The, you know, Marchetti shows up to arrest them. And so now we've got Suzanne and Antoine in jail, and Servier and Marchetti see an opportunity to kind of barter these resistance leaders instead of turning them over to the Germans, right? Because who cares about the Germans anymore? They see this opportunity to barter them for a written agreement that they will be treated, that they will get a fair trial, or that they won't be held accountable for what has happened, right? And this is, my guess is like, this is what's, and Servier is pretty interesting in these scenes because he's talking about, you know, he's such a
one legitimate government being replaced by another legitimate government. So I'll take hostages in the meantime. You know, it's such a mix of bureaucrat bullshit and raw kind of ISIS hostage taking.
It's exactly. And so they have this like funny meeting with what's his name? I'm back from vacation. I've forgotten everybody's names. With the head communist, and the head resistance Paul. Guy. Yeah, Paul.
And Anselm.
And Anselm. And of course, Anselm and Paul, like, not a lot of love lost between them. They're like sort of openly arguing about whether or not they should even be having this little meeting. But ultimately they come back and they say, okay, we will do this for, you know, bureaucrats, cops, blah, 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 but not Marchetti. Like, not for people who have real blood on their hands.
And not Milis. Not this, you know, irregular, well, semi-regular uniformed fascist force, right? There's a group of people that they insist basically on executing on site, including Marchetti.
And it's just like, it's interesting, like they just say it to his face and he seems to be resigned to this in a way that he has been kind of the whole time. He says it out loud a few times where he's just like, you know, there's not much time left for you or me. Like he just seems to know that he was on the wrong side of this and he's got his time is thin.
So Marchetti's psychology here strikes me as very interesting, you know, and not wholly dissimilar speaking of lost names, to Mueller's. You know, he's resigned to the fact that he is on the losing side. He seems to appreciate that comparatively early. He and Servier's wife both, you know, get that. And that he seems to have this, you know, almost pride against negotiating for his own fate. You know, he's like sort of, I made my bed and I'm prepared to lie in it. And he's not interested in, you know, Servier is definitely trying to cut himself the best deal and make arguments for himself. And Marchetti seems to think of that as unmanly and has an almost kind of romantic idea that he'll proudly face the firing squad whenever it's his turn. But the nature of his internal monologue about that is never clear, how much of it has to do with Rita and how much of it has to do with the fact that he's a sort of a sociopathic asshole and how much of it has to do with some kind of deeper philosophical commitments. But he's not a Shasanya, you know, who like is interested in arguing his way out of stuff.
Yeah, I think that's right. I agree with you that, you know, I watched it a second time knowing it was coming. And I was like watching their faces really closely, both he and Marie, because I remember when it happened last time, me being like, why is this happening? Like, there's this sort of top layer obvious answer where he knows that he's done for. And so like, why not, like, why not take out somebody who's judging him? Cause who cares? And he's got this sort of like evil nihilistic way of looking at her. But on the other hand, there's a resignation to him where it seems odd that he would like get up the gumption to feel like he needed to murder another person. And so, you know, obviously they, and then they have, she is goading him in this, you're not man enough, you won't do it. And I'm like, I honestly, like, she's the one I can't figure out. Like, I understand being mad at Marchetti, which I guess is the explanation. Like, he's standing there kind of presiding, or not presiding, but at least just hanging out with the Germans who are hanging civilians on the way out the door. And she is accusing him of, you're going to remember this moment for the rest of your life. You're in a position to stop this. Like, they're French, stop it. And so maybe she's just mad enough at him, but like, it always struck me, the scene makes me so mad because I don't want to lose Marie. And so there is this part of me when he says, sometimes a woman just needs to know when to shut up. Like, obviously I'm like, you know, go to hell, Marchetti, you're the worst. But there's this other part of me that's like, Marie, shut up. Like, stop. What are you doing? You don't need to get hung for this right now. They're leaving. So like the people on the bridge who decide they're not going to die in that moment and run.
So I don't have a good answer to that. And I think it's because there is no good answer to that. It's just one of these screenwriting, you know, which reflects a kind of reality that some people do things sometimes for reasons that are not entirely rationally explainable, where she basically taunts him into it because she's furious at what she's seeing. And what she's seeing is a horrible war crime. I mean, you know, the Germans have taken a group of hostages and are hanging them as a matter of retribution for the incident on the bridge and the deception associated with it. But she's also just doesn't believe that he's, I mean, she's just had this experience with him in which, you know, they're like, she knows that he and Servier are on the way out. And I think she doesn't believe he's, you know, about to do this. The other thing is it is out of character for Marchetti in the sense that most of his murders or whatever they are, you know, kind of in the line of duty. You know, he serves a murderous, terrible government, and he's a cop in that, and he, you know, arrests people under color of law and beats them under color of law and sometimes kills them under cover of law. But we have not seen him cold-bloodedly murder somebody before, completely outside of his reasonable duties as a Vichy cop would have understood them. And this is a situation, he does not arrest her, he does not, he just murders her. And, you know, that's not actually the Marchetti we have gotten to know. It's somebody who is consumed in the moment by a kind of misogynistic rage and a hatred of being on the losing side and a, you know, fear of his own future, you know, whatever the toxic brew is. But this is different from who he has been. Even the evil sides of him are more calculating and less rage-filled than that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I will tell you, you're right that life is chaotic and people do lots of things that we don't understand. But it is true that in both these situations, remember, our Marie is especially as the war is drawing to a close, Marie is careful. She's not, in fact, overly so. And so to me, if I have to lose Marie, fine. But it was always weird to me that this that both these characters did the things that they did in this moment, because neither of them seemed to be doing something where I'm like, oh, this makes total sense for who they are. You're completely right about, you know, he's usually shooting people in the back as they're running away from forced service or like delivering. And also, you know, the thing that they do with Marchetti basically
just interrogating somebody until they jump out the window.
Yeah, right. But the thing that they do with Marchetti basically up until this point, and actually it brings me to my overall point about why I think this happened, like narratively, is that they make Marchetti kind of complicated, right? He's a little bit sad and lonely, and, you know, he loves Rita, and, you know, they're just, they give you reasons not to hate him. Like, right, because part of the point of the show is
not
like—
good it's enough not, reasons.
Yeah, no, they're like, you know, it's not— it's not black and white, right? There's no, with the exception of Mueller, although even with him, you start to like just get so attached to him that you're like, well, don't kill this guy in a ditch. He's one of my favorite characters. Even though you're like, but he deserves it. And my point is that Marchetti is sufficiently complicated and does like weird things often that are, you know, displays of humanity. That just like this, yeah, this sort of like cold-blooded killing doesn't quite fit. On the flip side, I think that we are at a, when I say narratively, I just think we're at a part of the show where judgment is soon. And there was no reason for us to feel complicated about Marchetti, maybe. Like, I don't know if there's like, you know, like there's a, there's like, it's almost like they're just like, I want to make sure you see who this guy is or something. I don't know. But just going forward, like you, I don't know about you, but as a viewer up until this point, you're sort of like, okay, so they can't negotiate for Marchetti's life. But like, oh, I'll be interested to see how people judge like a cop who was like doing his job versus, whereas now it's like no redemption. Like redemption's off the table for Marchetti and even like, and I don't mean redemption, like in a real way. I mean, like in a, the show would give him a little bit of redemption because obviously he's beyond redemption morally for what he's done. But like, you could see how as a character, they would let him maybe slide. But now I think you watch this and know like, yeah, you're really done for. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, and the show, actually depicts that the last scene in that episode, if memory serves, is him not in a disguise, but with a hat pulled well over his eyes, slinking down the street, you know, trying not to be recognized. He's got none of the swagger. He's, you know, kind of creeping off into the sunset. And the implication is that he's now got the mark of Cain on him. You know, he's a kind of shoot on sight character.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Speaking of shooting on sight.
I just want to say one, before we turn to matters other than the death of Marie, I just want to say one word about your identification of Marie with Marie, which strikes me as not merely interesting from a, you know, who does Sarah identify with in the show perspective, but in a kind of parallel between the two of you, which I like and I think we'll point out. So, of course, Marie is the regional leader of the Gaullist resistance, which is to say the conservative resistance, which is to say if Marie were the publisher of a magazine, it would not be The Nation. It would be something like The Bulwark. You know, this is... people forget this about Charles de Gaulle, but he was a non-left figure in the pre-war era. And in fact, the left had a lot of trouble rallying behind him, and the Gaullists were the, you know, conservative non-fascist resistance, and de Gaulle had to work over the course of the war to convince people that he was actually committed to democracy. And so there is an interesting political parallel between the Gaullists and the Bulwark, right? This is, you know, hey, we're conservative, but we actually have certain pre-political democratic commitments. And of course, de Gaulle, after the war, becomes sort of a famously independent, to the great annoyance of the Anglo-American alliance, did not map on easily to post-war politics of the, you know, U.S. Variety. Moreover, one of the things you have always liked about Marie is that at all points, she didn't kind of hem and haw and she didn't wring her hands the way Danielle Larchet did. She just kind of did what was necessary. And of course, that has a certain parallel as well. And so I just wanted to say, if it ever, there is a reason, a sort of deep intellectual, philosophical reason, other than that she's among the very coolest characters in the show, why Sarah Longwell so identifies with Marie. And, you know, if we take the Stephen Millers of the world to be the Marquettes of the world, it is our holy mission to keep the Stephen Millers away from the Sarah Longwells.
Do you think I'm in mortal peril?
I don't, but you know, we're talking metaphorically here, and
yeah,
because the whole comparison is, you know, one is a military resistance to an armed occupation by the Nazis, and the other is
the other one we do podcasts.
Yeah, it's Trump, yeah. And we do podcasts about it. So, like, the whole metaphor is merely a metaphor. But I do want to say that I don't think people should just like think it's a random Sarah likes the really cool girl in the show thing here. There's something deep about the reasons why you find her a super compelling character.
Well, I find that to be a very generous analysis. But I do think, you know, obviously I'm like, I love Marie because she is a hero. I would aspire to be just like her, but the stakes are so different.
Stakes,
I mean,
they're different. There's a difference between running the regional resistance in Villeneuve and founding the Bulwark. I get all
right.
That, but it's worth pointing out that she's not Suzanne. She's not, you know, the Bernie Sanders wing of the, she is something like politically what you are today, which is the conservative world that said, wait a minute, we never fucking signed up for this.
Yeah, I'm going to take it. I'm going to take that. You know what? I'll tell you, it hadn't quite occurred to me, though, until you said it. And I'm remembering now that it is funny. There's that conversation between the communists and the socialists where they're, Antoine, I didn't sign up for this to, you know, to elect de Gaulle or something. Like, they are all arguing about that in the next episode. But I hadn't quite pegged that the Marie was more of a Gaullist.
Yeah, if their Joe Biden figure were Mitt Romney,
yeah,
that would be the, you know. But it's an important fissure, and it's not wholly different from your relationship with the Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez wing of the Democratic Party, that they're people you have to work with for a larger Democratic purpose, but you kind of never forget that, boy, Marcel Larcher isn't the person you'd be breaking bread with recreationally given your choice. And you know, it's not just her that's like that. It's also Anselm, who's a, you know, conservative farmer type, who doesn't have any, you know, he just doesn't want Germans to run his life, and he doesn't want Germans to kill his neighbors. And that's really different from Marcel Larcher, who has, or Paul, or even Suzanne, who the latter, you know, who have utopian visions of a different world. And it's different as well from Lucienne's husband,
Berrio,
sorry, who's kind of like me, I think, you know, sort of a, you know, kind of urbane, he's not urban, but he's kind of urban, right? And he's part of that sort of liberal set, completely different class than Anselm, and comes to it from a very different, you know, point of view. I think the show does a very, very good job of depicting sort of different gradations and different reasons why people get involved, including the sort of nihilist, because it seems like fun, of Raymond Schwartz, you know, and I think it's interesting who we, I think it actually does say a lot about our own political sensibilities, whom we identify with.
I totally agree with that. And, you know, I was sitting here when you were talking about me and Marie, I was thinking, like, who's Ben? Berrio is exactly right, is the short version. I was like trying to be like, is he Schwartzy? I think you're right about the Berrio comparison, as like, you are one of the leaders, but it is your like academic brilliance. You know, I don't even know if this is right for this podcast. I just remember the first time I met you, the first time I heard you speak at a conference, I was like, who is that guy?
It was all about Kenyon College.
Well, but that's not what you were talking about. That was the first conversation we had, because I went and sat down next to you at breakfast after I heard you talk at the conference. Because I remember you sort of talking, and I remember being able to not place your politics. Like, we were in a room that was cross-partisan, where like who was talking, like in the perspective that they were coming from, was very much on display. And I was listening to you talk and wondering, okay, wait, where is this guy coming from? But like agreeing with you, and which was one of the reasons I went and ran you down at a breakfast.
But that's so interesting, because that's Berrio, right? He's
exactly from a exactly class
from a class perspective. He's not at Larcher's level, but he's a bureaucrat. He's a school principal. He's relatively high status. He's quite well educated. On the other hand, he's aligned with the Gaullists, which is to say the sort of more conservative resistance faction. He works with them, but he's a Freemason, or at least he was, he's a liberal. So he's kind of this complicated political mix. He cheerfully accepts Marguerite's lesbianism, which is very forward-leaning from a 1940s, you know, perspective. And
you never gave me a hard time about any of that at all.
That's true. That's although I have to say I have that's a much easier sell in 2020 or 2016 whenever we met than it is in 1943 when he is presented with his appalled wife. Anyway, all of this is a digression from the actual episode of the show.
That's true. Apologies. It's very fun to play the who are we in this scenario game. I want to talk about one of the other sort of main storylines is that Mueller and Hortense are on the run. It has become clear they're not going to be able to get into Switzerland. And so they are trying to get into Germany. And so they got a plan. They're gonna say that they're a newly married couple. He is, you know, he's undercover as, is it Steiner? Who's he trying to be? He's got some fake name.
Trying to be some anti-fascist German civilian.
Well, he is once the Americans get to him. Because first what happens is they go to a checkpoint and, he kind of threatens the guy at the checkpoint. First he's polite and then the guy's not letting him through and he kind of does this like, get me your superior type deal. And unfortunately in the line, he is recognized by one of the cops, one of the people we see, having like a brief conversation with Marchetti, who like works at the police station, and he just IDs Mueller sort of accidentally. It's just like, oh, that's Mueller. And, the German, police or military guys immediately then grab him and like he's a deserter, and they have him digging a pit, his own pit, for his grave. And I will tell you, I love this scene in part because there's some like good acting going on where Hortense is like catatonic kind of at the notion that
Mueller's,
that she's going to die. Go ahead.
I just want to say, you know, this is one of the great acting performances. The Mueller, from the beginning of the show to the end of the show, it is a hateful character. It is an astonishing performance as an actor. And this is another example of that.
Totally. But there's also the like cosmic symmetry of him having, that scene that we argued about, you and I, about the motivations for Mueller, where he is talking about making the Jews dig their own graves before they shot them into them. And he is opining at the time on like, they know we're going to kill them and they're dutifully digging away.
Why did they do it?
And now he's digging and he's doing it, and you know, and I was sitting there thinking, and he says to Hortense, right? So Hortense basically she goes catatonic and she's just doing this thing where she's like, I don't wanna, you know, live without you. And he's telling her, like, choose life, like always choose life. It's better, like it's just a better bet than death. And like that is the answer to his rhetorical question for why people dig their own graves, is that they're looking for each minute, each breath is still preferential to the alternative. And he does that and gets, you know, very lucky in that the Americans, although I will say the lead American has a very weird accent that made me think he was British. I find the show, they did this before with our parachute guy where you're like, what nationality, like what is that accent? And it occurs to me, it's just that like whoever the French have doing these, like they might not be Americans because their accents are super weird. But the Americans show up at the last minute and shoot their captives. And that's when he puts his hands up and immediately, and it's a great acting performance, but also it's just such a window into what an interesting like character this guy would be, that he suddenly speaks, his English.
Perfect
like,
English.
Just the way he's been speaking French the whole time. And then he goes into German. And now he's just like, he puts his hands on immediately. He's speaking English. And it's disorienting as an American to start hearing him speak English out of nowhere. And he's got like a cover story just like in his head in that moment. I'm an anti-fascist underground. Like, I'm on your side. It's amazing.
Yeah. So I also think it is an interesting feature that the ruse only works for a short time. You know, he's got this amazing, pulls a cover story out of the air. You know, it's not like he's not under pressure. He's literally about to be shot. And, you know, he thinks on his feet very effectively. This is a person that we've seen really run the range of human effectiveness, from being an addled drug addict to being a highly effective torturer to being a very clever interpersonal operator in the politics of this little town. And when he needs to suddenly present himself in English, which is a language we did not know he spoke, as a anti-fascist underground guy, he's more than capable of doing that. But he is relatively quickly betrayed by his blood type tattoo. And this is another delicious little historical irony. The Nazis had two broad classes of people that they tattooed. One was concentration camp inmates, victims. If you were not gassed and you were actually admitted to one of the camps, you were tattooed with a number. And Holocaust survivors often lived the rest of their lives with numbers tattooed on their arms. But the other group of people that they routinely tattooed were SS officers. This is a cool irony that he is betrayed after being treated well and his cover story accepted. And the cover story is a good one, of course, because he was literally about to be executed by them. So it's completely plausible that they're executing an anti-fascist guy. But they bring him back to the base and they discover that maybe actually the guy with the blood type tattoo is probably SS. So I thought there were a lot of good ironies in there. It's not just that he's digging his own grave like the Jew that he's used in his power move, but it's also then that he is, you know, betrayed by his tattoo.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's really watching Mueller in just like civilian clothes, like being in this different, not like having to scramble as opposed to, you know, being in charge or in the power position is just, it's like, it's great. It's interesting to watch.
But I want to ask you about Hortense in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
So Hortense has always gravitated to the most powerful man in the circle. So Mark Kitty shows up. He's evil and willing to help her steal a baby. So she has an affair with him. And then, you know, a tougher dog shows up. And she's, you know, shacks up with him. She retains a soft spot for her husband. But, you know, that's the mere residue of sentiment that she's capable of. But now Mueller is, he's not the big dog anymore. He's on the run. He's not powerful. He's, you know, posing in civilian clothes and lying about who he is. Everything that was sort of you know, sadistically macho about him is gone. And she's really committed to him. And I don't get it. I like, what is her, like, what is she thinking? What is she doing? Why is she not willing to throw him over the edge of the bus and seduce the American commander?
So I don't know about seducing the American commander. I will say that it has become clear.
That's what old Hortense would do.
Maybe. I don't know. So these like, scenes.
Hortense in season one totally goes for the American commander.
Yeah. I mean, these scenes with the two of them, both the marriage, like the marriage that they hold for each other in the car, you know, they're lying, they're like on a log, like embracing, like, I think one of the things that I think they're trying to show us is that the intimacy and the love between these two people has transcended sort of its previous stage of like two psychopaths coming together.
There's clearly nothing like torture to bring a couple together.
Like, and that is, I think, you know, the scene where he is digging the pit and she's standing there, you know, they're stealing her shoes. He's asking them to spare her life, and she has no interest in that. She wants to be in the hole with him. And I think that could be, you know, and I think one of the themes of these episodes are the people who are sort of desolate and hopeless in the face of what they have done during this period. Like, there is no going forward for them. Like, they can't go back, right? Like, Marchetti, there's no safe space for him in Villeneuve. Same for Hortense, right? Like, she's Mueller's it. He's the last stop at the station, because you can't go back and expect people to be like, oh, we're just gonna, you know, reintegrate you into our village.
And yet, you do get the sense that Janine is playing a very different hand. You know, she's similar to Hortense in that she starts the show married to a prominent civilian, you know, bourgeois. She is, although she is actually of a different class entirely, she is deep in Vichy. She remarries a committed collaborationist. And in somewhat the same way that Hortense, you know, allies herself with the, you know, sexually and romantically with the occupation. And yet she wants to play her hand to get herself out of it. And Hortense is, you know, wants to help Mueller dig the pit.
Yep. I think that, like I said, I think they're really in love. Like, I think that's where we are. I think she does not envision a world where she goes on without him.
Which you know, occasional feature on this show of romantic advice. You know, I just want to say, don't be true to your SS officer. If you're the sort of woman who falls in with an SD officer torturer, and he, to make a point to your husband, cuts your arm in his office with a pincer, you don't need to help him dig his own grave when it comes time. You just don't need to do that. Walk away.
Okay, but let me just so agreed on the advice, but take Mueller. Like, this is the thing, right? Like, he too is like an evil, bad person who, when it suited him, honestly, professionally, he turned on her and tortured her. And now, faced with death, he doesn't.
And enjoyed it.
Yeah. He wants, no, but now he's bartering for her life. He is, and he has been sort of putting, like, the reason he's in this predicament right now is because he chose her, right? He chose her.
So here's my question. If you take her commitment to him, which is discretionary, his commitment to her, which is discretionary, And something we haven't talked about yet, which is having murdered Marie by the end of these episodes, Marquette is somehow plotting to see if he can save Rita again, who's on the platform to be sent to the last stage of the of Auschwitz. Hold that thought, because that's an interesting subject too. Is the theme here that these people who have done such horrible things are groping for something to ennoble their existence so that there's a kind of story that they can tell themselves in which they are not simply the villains, even for somebody like Mueller, who has at times so relished telling himself the story and telling others the story in which he is simply an evil villain. But now, facing the end, they actually want something to ennoble their existence a little bit, if only their commitment to each other.
I mean, I don't know how to answer that because it'd be entirely speculative, but I don't necessarily imbue it with that amount of, like, I honestly think the Hortense Mueller thing is like they're in love. Like, they have arrived at this place where they are in love with each other. Marchetti is a different animal, because I do think that Rita for Marchetti, besides being an obsession of some kind, is a weird type of loving. When you fall in love with, in this, you know, a Jewish woman, have a Jewish child, when you have been a person who has sent so many Jews to their death, and even it happens again, like in this moment on the train tracks, right? He's saying, because it would, the Germans are trying to make the militia, and Marchetti, who is now going to travel with the militia, take these Jews, and Marchetti's like, throw them off the train, who cares? And then, of course, he sees Rita, and everything about him changes. He goes from this cold, who cares about these people, to like obsessed with, and you're like, and you get the sense at watching him, like, this guy would murder everybody, put his own life, he would literally lay down on these tracks and put his life on the line for this woman and child, which is, and so to the question, to your question of like, is that about the story he's telling himself to imbue meaning with his life? Maybe, I don't know, but it certainly is like the deepest of ironies, and it is an, and it is one of the things about Marchetti that we know, which is everything about him changes when Rita's in the picture. He's a completely different person. Anyway, so I don't quite know how to answer that question, but let's go to the tracks, because we've now talked a lot. We haven't spent much time on the second episode in these two. So one of the things that's interesting, and I don't know if you historically, like this idea that they were going to, on the train, take these Jews to Germany.
Poland.
Oh, Poland. Are you sure they were going to Poland?
Well, I mean, it would go through Germany, because Germany's, you have to go through Germany to get from France to Poland. But the death camps were in Poland.
Huh.
This is something that the show depicts that seems completely insane and is totally accurate. And it's one of the weird, great pathologies of the Nazis. So this is most dramatic in Hungary, a little bit later in the war. But the Germans' commitment to killing Jews was so extreme that when they are trying to do orderly retreats, right, when they are trying to accomplish military objectives in the end stage of the war, it was still a priority for them to get trains with relatively small number of Jews to places where they could kill them. And, you know, there has been a fair bit of historical head scratching about this. Like, you know, why on earth would you prioritize killing civilians over, you know, military supplies, right? Why on earth? And the answer is that it was a fundamental component of their ideology. They were really, really committed to it. And so you see in this same period of the war, sort of, you know, late 44, this is the period in which they basically try to liquidate the entire Hungarian Jewish community. And it's amazingly late in the war that they, you know, that they try to remove the entire Jewish community of Budapest, which they basically, you know, do. And they do it with the Russians, you know, approaching Hungary, and they continue the operation until Budapest falls to the Russians. And so this is, you know, like, it is completely pathological, right? It's as though faced with the annihilation of the regime, there's a Marchetti quality to it, right? Faced with the, you know, certain defeat, at least we can take out a few more Jews, right? But they, you know, they did not always have working trains. They did not always have, their troops were not well supplied, particularly in the East. And this was a military priority for them, often to the frustration of the Wehrmacht, which, you know, was not especially interested in murdering Jews. But the regime's priority was, you know, put an enormous premium on it. And the number of Jews who died toward the end of the war, when you'd think the Nazis had better things to do, it's actually a significant percentage of the entire Holocaust.
Yeah, I guess it's just like logistically weird to me. Like, I buy that, like, okay, politically they were committed to this, but like, I don't know, they've got guns right there. Like, I guess it just like seems like you have to like transport people. Like, Marchetti's trying to solve this logistical problem by being like, just throw people off the train. But they are saying they're kind of doing this German efficiency. Like, the SS knows exactly how many people are supposed to be showing up, and they've got a list, and, you know, they better all be there. Anyway, it just seemed I'm glad you just brought up what you did, because I spent the whole time being like, if I were them, like, this just doesn't seem like a practical way to operate.
The answer is both things happened. And, you know, Villeneuve is a fictitious place. And so they get to take a little license. Look, 2/3 of the Jews of France survived the war. In the chaotic period of the end of the war, an enormous number of, this means 1/3 of them didn't survive the war. And there were a lot of Jews in France. And another detail that is accurate here is that foreign Jews, by the French definition of foreign, were dramatically less likely to survive the war than French citizen Jews. And so the Ritas and the Sarah Meyers had a 2/3 chance of not surviving the war. And the, what was his name, Ezekiel Cohen's, 2/3 of them are killed. 2/3 of the French, more than 2/3 of the French citizen Jews survive the war. And so there were a lot of killings by milice and by, you know, people who, you know, just kind of roundups, people got killed. As a general matter, most French Jews who were murdered in the Holocaust were deported by train to Auschwitz and other death camps. And so it is certainly the case that there would have been some just killings in this period on, you know, in of relatively small groups of people, one at a time, you know, 10, 15 at a time. It is also the case that there would have been people concentrated at railroad tracks waiting to be deported. And that's, you know, both things happened.
Yeah. Well, we just, so I want to just get to one last major plot point before we wrap. So we see Lucien, and this is, I guess, Berio, which I guess hadn't quite occurred to me, and I don't, has been gone for quite some time. She doesn't know where Berio is. And so she's asking the resistance fighters, then Schwartz, who are, have come to the school to lay out Marie's body, I guess, or, and she says, you know, and they know who Berio is, but they like haven't seen him since March. And so it's been clearly months and months since she's seen him. And to your point about these retreating armies, we get our first sense of they, you know, they do the liberation, the bells ring, you know, the whole thing is sort of the jubilation is stinted by the death of Marie, at least for the resistance fighters that we know. But pretty soon fighting breaks out again from these, like the retreating forces of Germans who have now like shown up in Villeneuve and have, commandeered the school and commandeered Lucien's baby, child, in to demand that they sort of treat the retreating German soldiers who are injured, wounded, etc. And that also strikes me, not like you said, Villeneuve is fictional, but geographically. So one of my best friends, Rebecca Frankel, I'm going to just plug her book really quickly because I just burned through it in the last 2 days. I'm going to have her on this podcast, by the way. She wrote a book called Into the Forest, and it's about the Jews that survived, Polish Jews who survived in the forest during the Holocaust. It's the most amazing book I've read in the last couple of years. And I'm not saying this just because she's my friend. It, like, I burned through it in a couple of days. But there's a whole... she does like
wonderful
an amazing
New York Times piece by her on this.
She did. She had a great New York Times piece. There's a great Wall Street Journal review of her book. Like, it's getting a lot of attention because it's fantastic. I had an early copy, part of it is just the amount of research, the reconstruction she did with personal journals to like get this story it's like a feat that you can't imagine. It's so good. But there's a lot in it about this period because they're in the woods and people are passing through the woods to retreat, right? Like the Russian army is advancing through the woods. The German army is like retreating through the woods. And so it still presents a ton of peril because there is this, and you just raised this point, and I think you're really right about it. There's like a metaphor of, I lost the thought. I had it while you were talking, but it was like a metaphor for, of judgment, right? This is like Marchetti kills Marie because she's judging him and he knows that judgment is coming. Like that to me, actually, when you were talking, that seems right. And so like people retreating, like Germans retreating, they want to kill anyone who's going to judge them, right? There's a need to eradicate the people who saw what they did. What is my point? Where was I going with this? That there's now we're seeing this phase of the retreating army that still shows up with their guns and says like you need to treat us, even though kind of the war is over and they're not necessary and they're on the losing side, but they can still roll into a village with their guns and demand certain things.
Yeah, we've talked about this before, but you know we think of liberation as a day, and that is wrong. Liberation was a process. And it was a process, you know, that was different if you lived in Normandy than if you lived in some of the areas where, you know, that retreated later where they had more time to do more stuff before they had to pack up and leave. It was different in towns where they left all of a sudden than in towns where they retreated to, right? And so this process is super, super variable and chaotic. And I think the, again, Villeneuve is fictitious, and so they get to construct the story about it that they want. But I think the idea that you don't really know on any given day who's in charge or who's, you know, who's going to roll in and steal your baby and make you treat their people. There's surely a lot of truth to that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, these were...
I'm worried about Berio.
Yeah. I'm worried about all of them. As Marie shows us, nothing is over yet. And all of our heroes who've put themselves on the line are vulnerable from a variety of different things. So, but great couple of episodes, tough couple of episodes. It's great to be back. And we will come back next week and do episodes, let's see, 5 and 6. We're going to get halfway through the 5th season. We are nearing not exactly the end, but you know, it's, I think we'll, if we keep our pace, we'll be done by November. Thanks all of you. I'm sorry we skipped a week. Benjamin.
Edith, take us home.
Nous nous aimions bien tendrement, comme s'aiment tous les amants.